Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. And I got to tell you, we have a great show today. My guest has had an amazing career, and I'm going to tell you one thing. He probably has the coolest name in the rock industry and music industry. I love his name. Ever since I was younger and I'd hear his music, I always remembered his name. And he has a new album coming out on February 7th, dedicated to his wife. It's called The Life I Got, to my most beloved. And my guest is Gino Vannelli. How you doing, Gino?
Hey, Steve.
So this is your man cave, you said. So you're in your man cave. And now I want to talk about the album, but I want to know, what is your creative process? You said you wake up in the morning, you produce, but are you someone who writes every day, or what's your process?
Well, it depends on, the project I'm involved with. Right now I'm finishing up a series of seven short stories that will be a book of seven. And that's the first book will be out this year. So I'm wrapping that up. I've been working on it for many, many years, and it's finally coming to an end. I also, I'm getting ready to go on the road, so I have some things to do, mock-ups to give the boys to learn for rehearsal, and working on a new record too. I just finished Life I Got a few months ago, but I like the process of continual writing. And I'm also doing some arrangements for the Quebec Philharmonic. I'm scheduled to do 5 or 6 concerts with them. So I like doing some orchestrations for new songs and for old songs that I've written.
Now tell me about, you said in the beginning, the book series is becoming in a long process. And I know I do comedy and I write bits years before and then I do them. And so you always have that little burning pod project that you always push off. I want to hear about the books, because are you writing a story? Are you singing? What is the book?
Well, it's kind of a combination. I mean, they're basically graphic verse novels or graphic novels, one play, and I'm writing the music for it too, like maybe 3 or 4 key songs, and we'll do some soundscaping, for the audio CD. But I mean, I'm very concerned with the details of the story, because In some ways they're fantasy stories, but they're really based on the concept of us, humanity, what we accept as plausible, and they were inspired by real life incidents. I mean, for me, for instance, I'm finishing, just put the last touches this week on a story called The Riddle of the River, and I was inspired by many years ago I was invited to go kayaking up near the Gulf of St. Lawrence, right at the top, where the river is like almost 80 miles wide. And it's 37 degrees. It was a beautiful day. The water was 37 degrees. It was a beautiful sunny day in spring. And the kayak instructor gave me the neoprene suit. I got into the racing kayak, which is very slim, so you have to really be aware of your hip movement. And for the first mile, it was quite mild. After we got past the first mile, it's like the river had a mind of its own and wouldn't allow me to go further, or it actually sucked me in, and as it sucked me in, it was kind of screaming to me at my own peril. And he told me, he screamed out from afar saying, don't fall in, you've got 10 minutes, even with the suit on. And it stayed with me for a long, long time. That for an hour, I tried to get out of that the cross currents and the 3 to 5 foot waves with a kayak, and the water was gray. It was misty. It was cold. Suddenly, it was very angry, and it was sudden. Also, combined with the fact that the day before, I had spoken to a few fishermen who fish along there, and there are sometimes such great vehement, violent storms near the Gulf, it's an estuary there, that some fishermen have drowned and some fell off, or their boats sank and were rescued by belugas. I found that very, very intriguing, and I asked how it happened, and one fisherman told me all the beluga did was dive under the person and lift him up and just transport him to the shore. I think it's so angelic, it's like, how do they know? And they must be feeling something that we're not sensing that they're feeling. In any case, those two elements are part of the Riddle of the River, and I wrote a more of a fantastic story that has something to do with an impassable river that is filled with creatures and some very compassionate.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm sorry, you have a great singing voice. You also have a great speaking voice. I mean, that's like, you have like that book on tape voice. Like, you could be reading this stuff, and it's excellent. So, I just want to give you that compliment.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get to the album, Life I Got. I want to talk to you. It's dedicated to your wife who passed, Patricia. And
yes.
How, you know, as an artist, you know, any, like, when people write a book, or if I write a joke, or when you write a song, they're always very connected to us. And we take it personal if someone doesn't like it. But how hard was it for you to dig into the well? Because you're married for a long time. What made you decide to write this album? And did the songs just come to you? And I'm sure there was nights where there was breakdowns, crying. You know, I'm sure it was impactful. But tell me about the whole process for this, because it is such a beautiful tribute. And for an artist to do something like this and then come out with it, and then now you're going to go on a road, is just what I would think is just wonderful, a wonderful accomplishment.
Well, it was written over a period of 3 to 5 years, and that's when Patricia started getting sick, about 5 years ago, and it was 5 years of struggling. I mean, 19 times at the emergency, and 4 major surgeries, and then the rehabilitation after the surgeries. So it's been a very difficult year. Of course, it's difficult for me, but for Patricia, it was. I mean, my heart would go out, and she would always feel bad about me taking care of her. That's one of the reasons why I built the studio here, so that I could be close to her. And because in the end, she needed me almost hourly. It's a very difficult process, because it really digs up so many feelings, feelings of faith or lack thereof, what happens to us, why her, the sweetest, you know, creature on this planet. All those. So you go through a gamut of feelings of sorrow, grief, anger, and whatnot. Loneliness, of course, being the worst of all. But I started writing because even before she got sick, I planned to dedicate an album to her. And I never knew that she would get this terrible NET cancer. And then I wasn't sure if I wanted to finish it, but then I thought more about it, and I figured, no, it demands to be finished. And you're right, towards the end, it was even difficult. I was in tears mixing it, especially songs like Stormy River and The Life I've Got. I figured I had to document it, because she meant so much to me. I mean, we were just going on our golden anniversary, our 50 years together. I met her when she was a child. She was 19 years old, and I was just turned 22. So we grew up together, in essence. And she was always there as a pillar for me, you know, helping me make decisions, telling me when she thought I was going astray or compromising too much or whatever. And we had such a great rapport. I mean, we would talk about all things, from the lowliest to the loftiest.
So when you're recording it and you're mixing it, do you feel really good about these songs? I'm sure, you know, and it's like anything. When you write, you want everything to be good. But for this, it must have been like extra special. I mean, did you feel like you needed to come through with that Gino Vannelli writing perfection? Because it is to your most cherished person, the person that means the life to you. And so I'm sure, as I said, with artists, we always overthink. You're like, I don't want to let her down. I mean, what was it like? I mean, did you do rewrites after rewrites, or did some of the songs just come to you in one sitting?
Well, certain songs like The Life I Got came in one sitting, because I just took stock of my life with Trisha. And the lyrics are, I never wrote such praiseworthy lyrics of someone. I've always been sort of keen on writing about what the darker side of humanity and how we work our way out of the dark side. And this was just a simple song about me loving the fact that she gave me everything, and I'm happy with the life I got from her. But a song like Stormy River, I didn't complete the last line till just, oh, months before Trisha passed. And the lines were in the open arms of my sweet departed love, that waits for me, because I knew it was coming. And of course, I didn't show her the song, the finished song. She was just busy trying to breathe in the last few months. But you're right. I mean, I wanted to make every word count, and I went over it and mulled over it and over it just to make sure that what I was saying mirrored my exact feelings, because I know a lot of people that are going through this. I mean, it's not in the thousands; it's in the millions, and we're all about to lose someone, or will lose someone, or we'll face it ourselves, in a timely fashion. But we will face it. And sometimes we lose people that we can can't stand, can't bear to lose. So I figured I had to be very precise in the songs about loss.
Well, you're doing a great job on it. Now, the final product, how do you feel about it? Like, when you look at it, do you think it hit it? I mean, I know you'll probably have some criticism on yourself, because we do that, but do you sit there and go, man, I accomplished what I set out to, and I'm really proud of myself?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there are some of my best songs that I've written. The Hero You See in Me, I mean, Nowhere to Go But Up, and I mean, they're all very, very well woven, well crafted, and I don't think I could have done better. I could have done differently, but interestingly enough, Steve, since I mixed it 6 months ago and handed it into to Sony BFD, I haven't listened to it. The only thing I've listened to is because of approving the videos. And approving the videos I proved very, very difficult, because it started really bringing up a lot of feelings still, from the netherworld within me. And so I'm not really re ready to comment really on it, maybe for another year or two.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, that's like, yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense. Now, I was reading up on you. I really want to hear about your early days, your early career, because you've had it's a fascinating life, like the stuff from the Pope and then the Soul Train. Is how now your father was a musician, or how did you get into music? When did you know? And you wanted to play drums, I believe. When did you
Did
what? So
I
tell me
did.
about that, because you have a great voice. And so tell me about the little Gino Vannelli getting into music.
Well, my dad was a cabaret singer, and I went to see him. My mother brought me when I was 3 or 4 years old, and he was wearing a white suit and looked very debonair, and I sort of was inoculated, with music, the stage at that point. And oddly enough, in the same breath, that night after I saw him, I fell off the second story of a bunk bed and ended up unconscious for half a day, with 30 stitches in the back of my head, and my parents thought I was dead, of course. So it had some prophetic thing about it. Years later, I was in a pharmacy or drugstore with my dad, saw a set of bongos, and the pharmacist took down the bongos, and I just started playing. I found that I could play without any lessons, and that my time was good. And so I said, "Dad, I want to play percussion instruments." And I was 7 or 8 years old. And then by the time I was 9, I got a small set of drums. By the time I was 10, I was taking lessons and really was serious about being a drummer, and played in a band that was a relief band at a club called Casaloma. And I saw a lot of great artists there, Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, and really their playing really influenced me. And I got to meet them and got to understand how they their thought process and how dedicated they were to their craft. And within 2 or 3 years, I became very curious about the piano, and I just sat down, and it all made sense to me. So I start to bang out some chords, And then I took some piano lessons. And of course, the band was filled with guitar players because of the British invasion and all. So I just would grab the guitar and start to play chords. And I loved the Brazilian music. I loved Antonio Carlos Jobim and wanted to understand all those interesting Brazilian chords that were sort of jazz influenced. So I started reading books on them and practicing, and I learned the guitar. And then it didn't dawn on me to become a singer till I was 13 or 14. And that only happened because our singer was trying to sing It's Not Unusual, but the early Tom Jones thing that came out in 1965, I think it was 66. And especially the ending, you know, when Tom goes off. And I was saying, no, do it this way. And so then he said, well, if you're so smart, why don't you sing it? He got really angry with me. So I, in a huff, I said, well, goddamn, I will. So we got to the first concert, and he played a little drum, so he got back there on the drums, and I was up there, and I was terrified. I had nothing. I didn't have a fortress around me. My drums were not there. All I had was a skinny mic, and I wish I was as skinny as the mic stands so I could hide behind it. But something strange happened. As I sang it, the more people gathered around, especially the cute girls, and I said, well, this could be very interesting. And so after I finished that, I decided that I was going to practice singing, and I was, and I, by the time I was 16 and 17, I started writing and singing, and then when I was 17, I got my first record contract with RCA Victor
now, in Canada. Now, you were in Canada, so
yes.
You get your first, now how does that first record contract, and I believe you used a different name at the time, am I right?
Van Elly.
Okay, which Gino Vannelli's so much cooler. I just want to tell you. That's just, you know, but the industry back there.
Well, I could never answer to Van. People would be calling out. I'd be staring at the walls.
So how did that first album sell? How did that, you know, because it must be first of all, it's an amazing feeling to be that young and have recorded an album.
It happened because there is this talent agent. It came to one of the clubs where I was playing when I was 16, and I never thought anything of it. And she called one day when I was going off to school. It was early, 7:30 in the morning. She says, I can get you an audition for, before Marcel LeBlanc at RCA Studios tomorrow night at like 7 o'clock or something like that. And I said, okay. And I thought nothing of it. And I went there. My dad drove me there. And we got to the studio. And Marcel said, hello. And he said, would you record something? Oh, I said, okay. And I just started combining all the instruments, played piano, played a little guitar and drums and bass, and built myself a little track within an hour or two, and then sang to it. And a few days later, they called back and said, okay, we're going to sign you, and let's record our first single. And the first single wasn't very good, you know, but it did manage to creep up top 20 in Canada. So it sort of gave me a buzz. And after that, I moved to New York. So I really wanted to expand and really learn from the ones who really knew how to make records. Because nobody really knew how to make records in 1970, 71 in Canada. It wasn't the days yet of Celine Dion and Bryan Adams. And it was still in its infancy. And the guests who were recording in Toronto, Montreal was still very... not very sophisticated. So I went to New York and managed to get in to see how people worked at Columbia Studios, where they recorded Simon & Garfunkel and Leon Russell and other artists, and learned a lot. And I lived there for a year and a half. I don't know how I managed, but I did. And when I got back empty-handed, but with a lot of knowledge. And I decided I was going to go to Los Angeles, and that's when I got signed to A&M Records.
Now, is it true you like hung out in the parking lot to get signed at AM, or how did you end up with AM?
Well, it's to some people who are faithful people or people of faith, it's nothing but a miracle, and to some people who are more, I guess, secularized in their belief, it's just serendipity, and you happen to be around for it. And for me, it was a serendipitous miracle. Because I had gone to church that morning only because I couldn't find any place to meditate quietly. And so the only place available to me was in the pews of an empty, absolutely empty Episcopalian church. And it was 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and there was already hustle bustle, traffic and so on. And it was a really noisy a motel my brother and I were staying at. So I fell asleep, and 3-4 hours later I woke up with really a clear picture in my mind what I had to do. And I hung out just outside the gates, was warned by the guards, and then I saw Herb walking in the parking lot, and I just dropped my guitar and ran through the gates and accosted Herb, and he was kind of a little freaked out at first, but he warmed up to me and asked me to come back to audition for him, and I did. And half an hour later, I was on A&M Records.
So, I mean, how nervous were you, though? I mean, I know you're a professional and you believe in faith, and but you know, you're auditioning in front of Herb Albert, and you met him, you know, just hanging out. And that, once again, I always think it's true about being at the right place at the right time and believing in yourself. Because if you didn't really feel that way, you probably would have never gone there, and you may have never got found. So, but was there a nervousness when you're sitting there, all of a sudden you're in front of Herb Alpert, and you're thinking it can change your life? I mean, especially back then, records could just complain, it did. But what was going through your mind? Because you're still a young guy.
Yeah, I was. I just was not quite 21 yet. I think yes, I was a little hyper. I probably had a heart rate that was like 80 or 90 or 100. But, the longing for, and you know, when you have to realize from the age of 16 to 21, that's a century, you know, to a teenager. Time moves very, very slowly. Each day is like being 10 hours on a flight to Serbia. And so it for me, I wanted it so badly that whatever fear, whatever nervousness or anxiety I had was completely overridden by my longing to do this. And when Herb lifted his head after resting his head on the back of his hand, listening to me for 20 minutes, I played Crazy Life and People Gotta Move and various songs from the first 2-3 albums. He just lifted his head and said, "Well, welcome to the family." And I didn't think like, yay, yay, yay. In my mind, it was, okay, now it begins.
So you begin the journey of, you know, of
yeah.
So the first album, how does it do?
Well, I didn't like the first album. I thought there were some really good songs on the first album because Herb and I were very different in our approach. Herb was the kind of guy where he would rehearse a band and quite loosely, and they would just, because of the good musicianship, we just put things up and it would sort of formulate, kind of just add water and pat it, and like a potter makes clay, just, you know, modulate and mold. Whereas I was a lot more methodical. I came from the 60s kind of understanding, like, I really love the way the Beatles recorded, step by step, analyzing and putting it together. Jeff Emmerich, who recorded all the records from Rubber Soul on for the Beatles, liked that about me because that's the way the boys recorded. I mean, they had an idea and then they would just kind of weave it, stitch it together. And Herb wanted to record it his way, and he advised me to do that, and it didn't come out the way I wanted it to come out. I didn't have time to put it together the way I wanted to put it together, but it did teach me that there were many approaches, and that the one approach that I could combine with mine was to indeed have a live group and have them so well rehearsed that we don't have to think about the arrangements in the studio. And that's what I did for the second record. So I went home, rehearsed a band, came back, recorded Powerful People, and we had a pretty big hit with People Gotta Move. And that was a little bit of both. It was my way, very precisely understanding, almost writing out every part, and Herb's way, where it's like, okay, just do it and see what it feels like. So it was a combination of planning, plotting, and allowing things to happen.
Now, how did you end up on Soul Train?
Well, I was saying, during Powerful People, I was recording Powerful People, and I was just at the end of it, and one or two songs were dogging me. And so when I went back to the hotel, which was the Hallmark on La Brea, no, on Sunset, it was this hotel or motel that everybody that was cool was staying at, especially the R&B artists like Curtis Mayfield and Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder, and everybody was used to stay there. And so I went off to the pool by poolside and fell asleep, and I woke up to someone singing my song, Crazy Life. And I traced it like breadcrumbs, and lo and behold, it was Stevie and his brother. And his brother said, "There's the guy." And Steve and I exchanged hugs, and I told him how much I loved his stuff and all. And he just came out with it, and he said, "Look, Chaka Khan is going to be sick for 7 or 8 concerts." He said, "And I need a replacement." He said, "I would like you to open up for me." And I, of course, was flattered, but I said, "You think? I mean, will I be alive?" I said, "No, no." He said, "You'll like my audiences." And he was right. His audience was a very, very musical audience. And he was gracious enough to even come out and introduce me. And those 7 or 8 concerts really made a difference in my life and career. And by the time I got to Cincinnati, I got a call, and it was from Don Cornelius. I recognized that voice anywhere. And he asked me to do Soul Train because he heard that I was on the road with Stevie. And lo and behold, People Gotta Move was racing up the R&B charts. It had already was like number 22. It was going to go in the top 20. And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to do it, but you know that I'm white, you know." And I said, "Yeah." He says, "We know." He says, "But we consider you off white here." And I did Soul Train, and again, it was a real boost, to my career. And then I handed in the record, and the record was just about out, yeah. And by the time I got on the road, it was out. And because me, Stevie, and I met 3 or 4 months before we decided to go on the road. In any case, I started my next album, and I didn't want to really aim for anything. I had so many ideas musically that I just wanted to put down. And Storm and Sonnet was just one of those records that came out that the record company didn't want to put out because there were no singles. But it ended up selling well anyways. So I was very proud of that.
Now, when you were touring with Stevie for those 7 shows, what size venues were you playing?
Well, they were big. They were 15,000 seaters.
So, how does a guy who's was afraid in the beginning to be in front of a microphone, hoping he's as skinny as the microphone, who really, I'm sure you didn't have a, you weren't used, no one's used to playing a crowd that big. How do you acclimate? Like, especially as someone who, and once again, you said Stevie Wonder's crowds are great, but a majority are African American. You're this white guy from Canada, How did you prepare yourself for the shows? And was it just as soon as you got out there, and it was, of course, having Stevie introduce you must have been a great boost because the crowd's like, "Oh, okay, this guy's cool." What was it like for you to get, I mean, how do you acclimate to 15,000 when you've never played a venue that big, and most people never will?
Well, it's the advantage of youth. You don't think about those things too much. You do. You feel them. You feel the pulse, the energy of the crowd. You feel the nervousness of everybody around you, for you, your managers, and so on and so forth. But I was one of those kind of guys that, okay, another step in my beginning. And I really felt that I wanted to do this till I was at least in my 70s. And so if I had to really break down at 22 years old, I could never get to 72 and do this.
So you're having a good career, and then you start scoring big hits. What is that like? What was what were your first top 10 was what was it? It was I can't, it's out of my tongue.
Well, I mean, the first big charting song was People Gotta Move. And then I decided that I didn't want to have singles, that I wanted to perform for my own audience. So this was a very major decision because I was managed by a very big managing firm at the time. and they wanted to put me in front of, they saw how well the Stevie Wonder thing worked, so they put me in front of Gladys Knight and this group and that group and whatever, and it never really worked out for me because that audience was not like Stevie Wonder's audience. Stevie Wonder's audience was a very musical audience, and the other audiences were not that musical and didn't really understand my music. Then the second thing was that I never had time to do sound checks and things like of that nature. So I decided to say, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to play small clubs and build my own audience. So by 1975, I said to my managers, I'm not going to do those big paying dates. I don't want them. I said, I want to play the small 200-seat clubs, and I don't care. They put me there for 3, 4, 5 days. There'll be nobody the first day, but by the second and third day, they'll sell out. And that's indeed what happened. All through 1975 and part of 1976, for a year and a half, we played small clubs and built up an audience very quickly, now that I think about it. And by the end of 1976, we were playing 3,000 to 5,000 seat halls. And what I really liked about it was that it was not because I was getting airplay on top 40 stations. People were buying my albums because they wanted to listen to something different. And so therefore I could go on stage and do things like the War Suite and do things like that were jazzy and whatever, that were not top 40, you know, was not top 40 material. And then by the time 1978 came around, everyone started pressuring me. See, if you're this big now and you could play 5,000 seats, think of what it would be like if you could have a top five single. And I always was very leery of it because I said, I will become a satellite of that song. Or a song, and I said I will have to play them till I die, else be booed. And well, of course, one day Ross came to my apartment and he played me the beginnings of "I Just Want to Stop," and I said, "Okay, yeah, let's." It's how could I say no to that?
Well, how is the record company reacting to you? Because I lived in Hollywood. I know it's all about money. When you're saying you want to play smaller venues.
As long as I sold enough records to make the money, they were okay.
Because okay.
The records were all selling 400,000, 500,000, 600,000. And so I had gold album. And it was just fine. You know, but, you know, people want to expand. And rightfully so. You know, it's an expanding universe. Why should a human being any different, whether it's a businessman or an artist. I wanted to expand, but I didn't want to expand this way. I wanted to go deeper. And that's when I wrote actually the symphonic piece that was recorded with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. And anyway, I did end up doing I Just Want to Stop, and it was a very big record, and the album was a top 10 record album, double platinum, and I knew what it was like. But then exactly what happened is what I feared would happen, is that now that you did it once, they want it again. And then I signed with Arista, and I wrote a song called Living Inside Myself, and they didn't want to release it. They thought it was too complicated. And I said, no, I said, you should release it. And so to boot, not only did I have to put out another song that would be a big single, but I had to be right about it. Despite their thinking that it wouldn't be successful. And so I won on two accounts. And then, boy, I mean, the pressure was double at that point. You know, I was almost an oracle. And so I didn't want to be that oracle. I didn't want to be beholden to top 40 radio because it's a very, very narrow, you know, very narrow road to walk. And the more you have success, the more people want to narrow you on that road. Well, let's make sure the next one is going to be big. So, oh, no, don't do those chords. That lyric is too lofty. And everyone gets afraid. And that was not my mindset. I wanted to keep expanding. And the road of top 40 was the road of narrowing, pinpointing. And So Arista and I had our differences of opinion, and it led to lawsuits and a lot of time lost, wasted.
Now, when you go back to I Just Want to Stop, what is it like for an artist when you have a top 10 hit, a top 10 album? How does your life change? And I'm sure American Bandstand, I don't know if you did Don Kirshner, back then there were so many great, the Midnight Special, there was all these great shows. You did them all. But what is it like for you when you're, it has to be, the world just must be buzzing around, flying around, because there's all this stuff going, and I'm sure people want, and people you didn't know come out of nowhere. I mean, when you start becoming a huge artist, how does that change? How did it change your life? And was it Patricia that kept you grounded? I mean, how did everything go for you when you hit your level of superstardom?
Well, the short answer is I didn't like it very much. I didn't like the spotlight like that. Now, of course, part of me enjoyed the fact that I had success. But I didn't like the things that came along with it because it was very distracting. I wanted to write, I wanted to read, I wanted to learn, I wanted to improve. I knew that I wanted to record. I had albums like Canto inside of me. I wanted to do classical stuff. I wanted to do jazzier work, so on and so forth. And so I knew that if I bought into it, it would be over immediately. And of course, yes, Trisha was very, very much part of that because I was beginning to be invited here and there to these parties or that, and I wanted no part of it. And because she was very Norwegian about it, very conservative about it, and hated that kind of lifestyle, and so it didn't mean that much to me. I would, after Brother to Brother was a very big success, I did the tour, and already I was very deep into Nightwalker. Looking for musicians, auditioning musicians for that record. And then the 80s was something else, you know, I because of the lawsuits with A&M, I mean, with Arista and all, I had to go a different direction, and I went to Europe. And it ended up being a little bit of a blessing in disguise, because most American artists didn't concentrate that much on Europe in the 70s and 80s. It was always an adjunct to your American success. Whereas I went there, and I was signed to a European company in France, and actually stayed there for months on end, working and doing TV, press, and all that, and really built up quite a career.
Now, I did not know, but I want you to tell me the story about how you came to perform for the Pope, and that whole, and your album was in different languages. Tell me that story, because as I said, when we hear songs, if someone's not on my show, I don't, you know, you listen to the music, you like them. Like today, I love Black Cars, and I love Appaloosa. They're cool songs. I was driving today, I'm like, I put on Amazon, I put the Tino Vanelli play, and I was just like, you hear songs that you don't hear a lot, and you're like, wow, that's just great, because you have such a diverse body of work. It's always great when you sit there and go, oh man, like you can change shifts. Like it's not like when you hear doom, doom, doom. But tell me about the Pope and that album, because it's fascinating.
Well, I had it in my heart that I wanted to record. I started writing some classical material. And there's not a record company in the world that wanted to record that kind of material. It was very serious to me. Well, one day, Trish and I are having breakfast upstairs. It's early in the morning, 7:30, and the office phone rings, and I have to march downstairs. And I was pretty certain, after hearing who was on the opposite end of the line with a very, very thick Italian accent, that it was my friend Vito from Toronto, who was always playing jokes on me and, you know, pretending he was some kind of holier than thou oracle or whatever, and then saying something stupid. And so I listened to who I thought was Vito for a few minutes, and I just said, Vito, fuck you, you know, like, and I just slammed the phone. And my wife said, well, who was it? And I said, it's Vito again, he's doing his stupid shit. Phone rings again. I said, oh, this is really this is annoying. So I went downstairs, and before I said a word, the voice on the opposite line said, Signora Benelli, he says, please don't swear at me. He says, it's Bishop da-da-da-da. And it really ended up being a bishop from the Vatican who said that the Pulp, I heard one of my songs on a very, very esoteric record that I recorded, a Danish jazz artist that I produced and just played one of my songs. And it happened to be a classical type song called Parole per mio padre, which is a word to my father translated. He said the Pope liked it very much and would like you to perform that song at his at the Christmas Jubilee, 2000 or 2001. And I was really taken by it because I always admired Pope John Paul, and I got to know him even better studying his life, some of his plays, some of his poetry, and what he had accomplished in the 70s against the KGB and how he helped free Poland. So he was not just a man of words, he was also a man of action. So meeting him was really, really a treat for me. And singing for him, but meeting for him especially. And he was kind enough to meet with my wife, my son, and talk to me for 10 or 15 minutes.
So,
what happened was I gotten very ill. I didn't know if I could perform, but I did it. They injected steroids in my vocal cords so they could open up. And it was very dangerous, but I eked out that song. I suppose the performance is okay, but considering what shape I was in, I had 103 temperature. And as a result of it, BMG heard Parole per mio padre, my singing at the Pope's Jubilee, and called me 2 days later and said, would you like to do a record of all those kind of songs? And that's how Canto was born.
Now, I mean, you're an artist, but how do you top? I mean, think about it. You just perform for the Pope. I mean, it doesn't get like, it's not like, you can perform in front of 500,000 people, but you perform in front of the Pope. I mean, that must have just, you were sick, but that must have just, the adrenaline must have, besides the shot, the adrenaline must have just kept you going.
Well, you know, performing for a Pope is no big deal to me because I don't agree with all Popes. But John Paul is special. I mean, Popes are people. You know, they have some ideas are good, some ideas are bad. I like Pope John for his openness, but for his ability to know this from that, for his ability to understand that free speech liberties were important for the inner spirit of man to express him or herself. He understood the importance of that, and that was profound for me because he was a playwright and a poet. He understood that you needed to be able to speak and speak freely. And that's why that's why I was so keen on him. And you're right. I mean, performing for him was a high, but he died shortly after. Yeah.
Now, you did a live record. I still call them record and albums. Live in L.A. And that was at the Seaman Theater, which I lived in L.A. for years. And that you always drive. It's so funny when you live in L.A., you drive by them every day and you don't think, I was there for 15 years, 16 years, and you don't think anything of it. You know, but then you hear people visit, oh my God, I went to the Seaman Theater. You're like, I just drove by that, you know, or I used to go to, you know.
It's a nice theater.
Yeah, so, but no, before that, you didn't perform in L.A. for a while. Was there a certain reason why you didn't perform in L.A.? Did you just not want to go, or what was it?
Transitions, you know, the right promoter, the right hall. Suddenly we got a call from Lance at the Saban or Saban, and we said, okay. And we thought it was such a special event. We hadn't been there 10 years that we'd record it. And SRG wanted to record it, film it, and that's how we got live in L.A. And we just recorded Volume 2, in Serbia, 3-4 months ago, and we're gonna edit it and mix it, really something special, and it's got 11-12 songs that Live in LA doesn't have, so it's gonna be part two or volume two.
How do you end up in Serbia? I mean, it's just so random because it's funny. Real quick, 5 years ago, 5 minutes, I got married to my now wife, And we took our honeymoon in Croatia. And no one was going over there. You know, and because I then Yugoslavia. We said, this would be cool. And then Game of Thrones got big. But Serbia, how do you choose Serbia to go and perform? Do you have a big fan base there?
Yes, and it chose me. Someone wanted to do a date last year, and we did a concert, and it turned out to be very successful, and invited us to not only do a full concert at a brand new theater that was opening up, but invited us to use their facilities to record our two videos for The Life I Got. And so we did Stormy River at Pink Media in Serbia, and we did Nowhere to Go But Up, those two from the new Life I Got record, recorded in Serbia. These huge studios that they use for major movies and television there.
So now you're doing live tours. You've been doing it for a while. What's it like now being on the road? I mean, do you still love it? I mean, it's, you know, and as you said, you never wanted to be the person that had to play those songs again. But then, of course, people want to see that. And I think artists work for the fans. But what's it like to be on the road now? Because you must see fans that are, there's parents, even grandparents, that bring their kids and their kids. I mean, what's that like as an artist to see and to go, you're generational?
Well, I think the overriding feeling is one of gratitude, gratefulness, that I could still do this, and that people are still there. And the second level of gratitude is that I'm able still to do it. I wouldn't go on the road if I couldn't do it. Most of the songs are still in the original keys, and I enjoy singing them. And sometimes I'm singing them saying, who the hell wrote this? It's difficult to sing. And so, I mean, it's a process for me. I start working out a lot. I start singing so many songs per day, take a day off, do vocal exercises, get myself as fit as possible to do this show because it's a two-hour show. And then I have the best musicians that I could possibly find. And they really work hard, too. They always go over the stuff. And it's really, I enjoy it because it's so well done around me. I wouldn't enjoy it if it would be full of potholes. I just wouldn't want to do it. I've always had great bands. People came to see me from 1974 to just last year when I just did my last date. They always would see a great band, well rehearsed, great sound, great soundscape. My brother does sound. It's not a religion, but it's pretty damn close.
Well, okay, so you surround yourself with these great musicians, and you put on a great show. And so how is the difference of Gino doing that show than when you work with a symphony? Because I know you do a lot of that work. It's got to be, it's got to be a different ballgame.
Very different.
So how do you acclimate to that? Because this is fascinating. Like, you go from these shows and you go with a symphony. I mean, it's fascinating.
First of all, stop moving your arms because the conductor is getting confused. That's the first thing. Second of all, you know, no hip movement. even if you're feeling the rhythm, you just sort of stay calm. And vocally, not that I don't like to sing precisely with the band, doing the band stuff, but there's an extra 5% of precision that needs to be there. Diction, vibrato, things, because you're fully exposed with an orchestra. But it's a hell of a kick to really, because the arrangements, most of them I wrote myself with some help from Glenn Morley, my friend in Toronto. Simon Leclerc wrote some of them from Montreal. But understanding the arrangements and feeling the arrangements, knowing where it soars, where it doesn't soar, it's really a hell of a kick singing with a full orchestra.
Now, you've had this great career. I'm going to tell me the things that you're really proud about. What has made you proud? Because everyone, you know, some people, you know, you get different answers. I always ask different actors and musicians this. You know, what makes you proud? Some people will say, I pay for my kid to go through college. Some people will say, having a huge hit. For you, what are a few things that made you proud? Because you've done so much and you've lived a life that a lot of people don't. So what are some things that makes Gino Vannelli proud?
I don't think there's anything that makes me proud. It's not that. That's not a sense of accomplishment for me. what makes me feel right is when I hear a song that was recorded, maybe, well, I'll give you an example. There's a writer I communicate with. I'm helping her edit her book. And she doesn't really know who I am. She's younger. She's in her 40s. And I mean, she knew who I was, but not that familiar. And suddenly, we're on talking about her book. And she said, I just Googled Just to the Gemini, the War Suite, and listened to the whole thing. She goes, oh, my God. You know, but she went on and on and on. How old were you when you did that? I said, I was 24. And the fact that she's enjoying it so much doesn't make me proud. It just makes me happy. So there are certain things about my career that make me happy. And the things that make me happy are the things that I did right, that are still stand up today, that are authentic. And the fact, what makes me happy is that I listened to just the other day something from Wilderness Road, which is like 2019. And Ross just sent me the new edit to Nowhere to Go But Up, which is 2024-25, and I like it very much. Those are the things that are, you want to talk about proud, well, it's what I wouldn't say what I live for, but a good amount of living for.
I have two quick more questions. One,
yeah.
What's the first, do you remember the first time you heard yourself on the radio?
Yeah.
Okay, I want to hear about that.
Yes. I was ashamed. That's not proud. Because when I was 15, 14, 15, 16, I hadn't realized what kind of a Montreal accent that I had. It's a strange dialect. It's a dialect from Eastern Montreal, which is a combination of English, French, and Italian. And so you sort of blend those three, and sometimes you'll go off even into a little Italian or go off into a little French and then come back to English. And it's definitely a Montreal dialect. And so when I was being interviewed, I heard myself. I said, oh, my God, I'll never make it with that. It's kind of like a French Rocky, you know. And I talked to my dad about it because he was plagued with it, you know, tenfold. And so I said, how am I going to do it? And he said, one of his teachers told him, read the newspaper and record yourself while you're recording, while you're reading the newspaper. And so this is what I did for 6 months. I read the Montreal Gazette with a tape recorder on and just read almost like the telephone book.
Well, when's the first time you heard yourself singing on the radio?
I didn't quite feel as ashamed, but I felt like I'm not even close, you know, to being happy. I didn't like the mix. I didn't like what the key I sang in. I didn't like my enunciation. I said, okay, we'll just dump that and start over again. And that's the only way to improve, is really to keep shedding that skin. You don't build upon garbage because you'll just fall. You got to throw the garbage away. And by the time I got to Powerful People and Storm at Sun Up, okay, now I'm making the records I want to make.
Okay,
you have to find your process.
It's, and that's good, and you have, and you've gone across different genres, which makes it perfect as an artist, and I think that's how artists grow. I think that's how people grow, because some people do get pigeonholed. So, the last question. I want you to tell me a short story about an oh my God moment you've had in your career, where you're like, holy, I've arrived. And I know you're a very modest guy, I can tell. So this might be hard for you, but because you're very, but what were those things you may have said, oh my God, I've arrived? Just something that was a really cool story.
Well, I'd have to really think back, but I don't think I've ever felt like I've arrived, because I always felt like I was just passing through. And I wanted to just do my best as I was passing through. The years go by so quickly, Steve, that, I mean, here I am, you know, in my early 70s, thinking back on the first record deal I had when I was 17, never thought that the years would pass so quickly, even though they seemed to pass so slowly at the time. But something inside of me knew that I was just sort of, you know, sitting on a seat on a train passing through life, and that I was going to see as much, learn as much, express as much as I could. And I'm not quite done yet. I'm very much looking forward for this Book of Seven to come out, and another record, and some of the other project. Now, right now, we've got 20 concerts we're going to do in 2025. I haven't been on the road now for 4 or 5 months, so I really need to get myself, you know, back up to a level where I feel like this is easy. Well, so, I mean, you know, it's like far-reaching, but also things that are close at hand.
Well, this has been great to you. You're a very insightful guy. I really, and as a fellow creator, I really appreciate, you know, just your trueness to your craft. And you don't see that a lot. People change. But I want to thank you. People, go to GinoV.com. Go to GinoV.com. The new album comes out February 7th. He's got the videos for Stormy River and Keep On Walking up there. The Life I Got, To My Most Beloved. You want to buy it. And you want to go back and buy his old albums and listen to his music, because you're going to love it. So check out Gino. Go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find over 1,030 episodes. You can email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. Twitter, I'm at coopertalk. Facebook, I'm coopertalk radio. So keep listening to music. Keep supporting live entertainment. I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guest. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.